Oh, the beach was incredible. It was packed, packed, packed. As I said, blankets on top of somebody else's blanket that was touching. And the sands, I remember, were sometimes so hot you had to walk on people's blankets, you know, the edges of a blanket to get to the shoreline.
You're listening to Coney Island Stories, the oral history podcast from the Coney Island History Project.
I'm Charles Denson, director of the Coney Island History Project. Welcome to Episode 8 of Coney Island Stories. On Memorial Day weekend, lifeguards will once again be perched in their towers, and the city will celebrate the reopening of Coney Island's beach for swimming. One of the questions visitors ask at our exhibition center, which also opens Memorial Day weekend, is when did Coney Island become a seaside resort? We can go all the way back to an August 1823 article in the New York American announcing that the road and bridge leading to this delightful island are now complete. It is open to the ocean with the finest and most regular beach we ever saw. Or did it begin with the opening of the Coney Island House, the island's first hotel 6 years later? When the poet Walt Whitman lived in Brooklyn from 1836 to 1850, he described the Coney Island beach as a long, bare, unfrequented shore, which I had all to myself. There I loved, after bathing, to race up and down the hard sand and declaim Homer or Shakespeare to the surf and seagulls by the hour. By the mid-19th century, ferry service and a steam railroad connected the dune-covered sandbar that would soon become the world's playground to Manhattan and the entire world. Today, we're sharing stories of days at the beach from the 1920s through the 1990s, taken from the History Project's Oral History Archive. Coney Island became known as the Nickel Empire in the 1920s when a Nathan's hot dog, a spin on an amusement ride, and the subway ride to get here cost a nickel. Before the boardwalk opened in 1923, most access to the beach was through narrow, privately owned alleys leading to toll gate hotels and bathhouse pavilions. The Riegelman Boardwalk made the beachfront public for the first time in 50 years. Swimming attire of that era was very modest. Men's bathing suits had tops, and women wore skirts and stockings on the beach. Patrolmen acting as beach censors were kept busy enforcing the city's public decency ordinance. On one July day in 1928, the Brooklyn Eagle reported that 125 Coney bathers were fined as much as $5 each, the equivalent of $75 today. Their crime? Walking on the boardwalk in bathing suits or walking on the streets in wet bathing suits without robes over their suits. In this 2009 oral history, Joseph Albanese, who was born in 1922, recalls what it was like to visit Coney Island's beach in those days. Who are we speaking with today?
Joseph Albanese, 87 years old. And I used to come to Coney Island when everything was a nickel. Everything, even the trains. But what I like is when we used to be able to walk underneath the boardwalk. You know, you used to go get your stuff. You didn't have to go upstairs. The cops used to chase us down if we had bathing suits on. At that time, downstairs, go from underneath.
That's right. They didn't let you on the boardwalk.
They wouldn't let you on the boardwalk without the, because you had... That store had a store here and a store down below. The same thing. If you wanted a hot dog here, you go upstairs and you could put the mustard on. But you couldn't go on the boardwalk. They were very strict. And you couldn't walk. That's why everybody had stores on the bottom. They had the store on the bottom and the store up on top. If you put your pants on, you could go upstairs. But they wouldn't let you go with a bathing suit. I couldn't understand it. And in those days, I remember the bathing suits were like skirts. You had a bathing suit and you had a skirt.
Men had to wear a top.
Yeah, we had a complete top. I got pictures home of when we were kids in Coney Island.
In July of 1935, during a heat wave, headlines trumpeted the greatest crowd in Coney Island history when more than 1 million visitors jammed the shorefront. Jurisdiction over Coney Island's beach and boardwalk was transferred from the Brooklyn Borough President's office to the city's Parks Department in 1937. Its commissioner, Robert Moses, famously said that bathers at Coney Island have just about the same square footage as required for a coffin, 16 square feet apiece. The packed beaches of the 1940s still evoke awe in aerial photos taken from the parachute jump, which was brought to Coney Island from the 1939-40 New York World's Fair. In 1940, Moses used beach crowding as an excuse to move a large section of the boardwalk inland, resulting in the demolition of many of the beautiful amusement buildings erected in the 1920s. He was not a fan of the amusement zone. In this 2018 oral history, Connie Scacciaferro shares memories of going to Coney Island as a child in the 1930s and as a teen in the 1940s.
We'd all meet at Union Square, take the train to the Sea Beach train at that time to Stillwell Avenue, Coney Island, and get off and go, I forgot what bay, and we'd have our family with blankets and shopping bags and sandwiches and drinks and things like that. And it was families from all over, I imagine. That was the way we could get to the Coney Island, was by train. Nobody really had a car too much. I went with my mother, my father, and my two sisters, and then we met my grandmother and my aunts and cousins from different places, and we'd all go be on the beach together for this family. We call it the family outing. Anybody that could carry a shopping bag when we were little carried a shopping bag on the trains, you know, to the beach. We'd have sandwiches and drinks and everything, you know. So it was lovely.
Were there a lot of people on the beach?
Oh, the beach was incredible. It was packed, packed, packed. As I said, blankets on top of somebody else's blanket that was touching. And the sands, I remember, were sometimes so hot you had to walk on people's blankets, you know, the edges of a blanket to get to the shoreline.
Mm.
Yeah. And everybody had their best bathing suit on, you know, the girls. And we wore bathing caps, these bathing caps, because when we took them off, we didn't want our hair to look, you know, all wet and straggly, you know. So we always were conscious of the way we looked. And, you know, we had to always have curly hair and all, you know, or have the hair looking perfect. So we used to wear these bathing caps, which were... I look at a picture and I start laughing. I says, how ridiculous, but that's the way it was. Everybody wore them. When you took off your bathing cap after you came back from, you know, your swim or something, your hair was nice and dry and fluffed out, and it looked presentable.
Yeah, and what were the swimsuits like?
I had strapless bathing suit. I can't remember the name, like I said. They used to have certain names of bathing suits that was supposed to be, you know, most fashionable. So we'd save our money and buy that one. Then one of my friends had a two-piece bathing suit, and it wasn't a bikini at all, you know, but it was two-piece, and we thought, whoa, you know, she's, you know, daring. But you look good, you know.
In 1956, my family moved into a New York City housing project called Coney Island Houses, where the beach was at our doorstep. Sunny summer days were beach days, and everyone left their apartments carrying umbrellas, blankets, coolers, and folding chairs for a day-long encampment on a beach filled with hundreds of splashing, laughing children. Jetties divided the beaches into bays, with each bay numbered. The bays were territorial. Some were predominantly Italian or Irish, and others were populated by people who traveled from other Brooklyn neighborhoods. In this 2019 oral history, Richard Termini, who grew up in Bensonhurst in the 1950s, shares his boyhood memories of the Coney Island beach.
That feeling to be in that unbelievable heat, you know, that 100-degree summer heat, and then you go under that boardwalk, and that instant cool, you know, the sand and all that, and the darkness of that, and the smell of the sort of oil-soaked wood or whatever they did to prevent it from drying out, had that sort of aroma. And then you come out of from under the boardwalk, and now this lava hot sand, you know, and your little kid, and you'd have to make your way to the beach. And the Knish guy, you know, hot Knishes, cold sodas, hot Knishes. And he'd throw the Knishes. I mean, if you remember any of this kind of stuff. But my dad would yell, three Knishes and two sodas or whatever. And he'd throw the Knishes. And then he'd say, I'll come back with the soda. And then when he comes back, he'd give you the sodas because you want to throw the sodas. And you pay him. So that's what he would do. He'd throw all of his, and then he'd remember to come back around and take all the money and give everybody the sodas. So, you know, when you're 3, 4, 5 years old, this is a marvel to see all this kind of stuff. And in those days in Coney Island, and you could scoop into the sand, you know, like where the water would hit and recede, you know, the wet sand, and you'd pull out baby crabs and things. And if you were like in ankle deep water, you'd see little fish swimming around and, you know, you could see life in the water there. And I remember, like when it was about 10, 11, 12, you didn't see that anymore. You know, all that sort of, so it was still around when I was really little, that it was still alive.
One of the earliest newspaper accounts of recreational bathing in Coney Island was recorded in 1801, when a boating party from New Jersey landed on Coney's beach and three swimmers drowned in the surf, despite attempts to save them. Being a lifeguard in Coney Island was an aspiration for neighborhood kids who grew up on the beach. Among the lifeguards, past and present, who have recorded oral histories for our archive are a few who have worked for a decade or more and describe it as their dream job. In this 2018 interview, Ron Vernon, who was a Coney Island lifeguard for 48 years and worked his way up to chief, remembers his first day on the job at age 17 in the 1960s and the rescues that stay with him.
Lifeguarding was a lot of fun. There's the water, there's the sand, there are the girls. But every once in a while, that something would happen where you know, you became an essential part in somebody either being okay or not okay. And it was a great responsibility, but I liked that responsibility. And I was always alert and ready to go. And when I had to go, I did. And that was very exciting.
Do you remember the first summer that you chose to be a lifeguard, what your impressions were?
The first year, I remember very, very well. They would assign you, and if you were a new lifeguard, they had assigned you where they needed you. So I remember being online, hoping, saying to myself, oh, I hope I get close to home. The head of the lifeguards was up there, and he said, son, where do you want to go? And I said, well, I live very close to Seagate. I actually lived in Seagate, and I would like to stay as close to home. He says, fine, you're assigned to Section 6, which was the section I wanted to go to, and I was really happy. I think I was walking on air. I remember I couldn't wait to get the uniform and try it on. It was something that I wanted since I was a little kid, so I couldn't wait. You know, I got it, and then I went out to the beach, and I remember sitting up in the tower that first time. I was a little bit startled because I relieved the lifeguard, and they left me totally alone. So I says, uh-oh, I hope nothing bad happens. I just wasn't prepared. You know, here I am, 17 years old. I took the course, and I remember a woman came over to me and she said, I can't find my son or my daughter. And you could see she was nervous. So I asked her how old and whether it was a boy or a girl, and she told me, and I stood up on the lifeguard chair and was looking for this little boy or girl, I don't remember. And all of a sudden, all the other lifeguards on all the other chairs stood up and started blowing their whistles. And I go, uh-oh, I screwed up. And the chief lifeguard, who I still know, who was my original chief, he's now director of New York City Lifeguards. I know him since I'm 17, came over and said, why are you standing? I said, I pointed to the lady. She lost her son. She can't find her son. He said, sit your ass down. That's not an emergency. And I knew I was in trouble. I guess I didn't know the ropes yet. Anytime you stand up in the lifeguard chair, you're supposed to signal. There are different signals. There are 6, 8 different signals. I didn't signal. I just stood up. So when the other lifeguards on the chairs on my left and right saw that, they assumed that there was an emergency going on. So they stood up, blew their whistle, which meant the chief lifeguard would come running to see what was going on so he could deal with that emergency. And a lost boy is not considered an emergency, a lost little girl. So I learned real quick. Back then, it was different. They taught you differently. I spent that next day on the jetty, all 8 hours. He said, bring your lunch tomorrow. I said, why? I said, I like to go up on the boardwalk and get a slice of pizza. He said, just bring your lunch. And I walked out. He said, get up on that jetty. I want you to watch both sides of the bay. I don't want you to move until it's time to go home. Yeah, you learned real fast. And I knew not to stand up in the lifeguard chair unless it was an emergency. So that was lesson number one, first day.
Was there a time when you rescued someone that seems very memorable to you?
There were about 3 or 4, and there were some disappointments too. I was involved in rescues where people didn't make it, and that was very traumatic, stuff that I would never forget. There were some very special rescues that I felt very good about, and then there were certain things that had happened that I responded in the correct way and gave a full out effort, but you know, it didn't come out for the better, and that stays with me too. That definitely stays with me.
Some of the first summer jobs once available to Coney Island kids when they turned 14 and could get their working papers no longer exist today. The M&C Chair Operating Company was owned by Bob Myers and operated in Coney Island from the 1930s through the 1970s. At the height of the operation, Myers hired hundreds of workers to rent beach chairs and umbrellas at under-the-boardwalk tin shacks located on alternate streets from Seagate to Brighton Beach. Myers also had rolling chairs lined up in front of the Ward's Bathhouse building, occupied by sun worshippers who used them year-round until the late 1950s. M&C's headquarters was on West 12th Street beneath Ward's Kitty Park, where Dino's Wonder Wheel Park and the Coney Island History Project are now located. In this 2015 interview, Steve Larkin, who grew up in Brighton Beach, shares his memories of working his way up from schlepping chairs to being a cashier and manager with M&C in the 1970s, when the number of stands had dwindled to 8. He also describes the life lessons he learned on the job.
Back when the boardwalk was elevated over the sand, and there actually wasn't under the boardwalk, the station I used to work at most of the time was at Stillwell and the boardwalk, and there was a lifeguard station and there was a beach chair and umbrella stand. And it was underneath where Stouch's baths used to be. And that's my first gainful employment. I tell my son all the time that, you know, the busy height of the season was like 4th of July weekend. It was always, you know, the story was there'd be a million people on the beach. We would sometimes actually sell out of our chairs and umbrellas. We had, you know, probably thousands of them. We literally didn't have cash registers. We literally would make change out of cigar boxes. And it was $2 and you'd give the change. But on busy days, sometimes there'd be a couple of $1,000s in the cigar box. So Bob, who owned the company, would freak out and didn't want that much money sitting there in a cigar box. So we would load some days $2,000-$3,000 in cash in a paper bag and walk it from wherever we were on the boardwalk to deliver it to his office. Saying, you know, we were 14, 15-year-old kids holding a paper bag, like a lunch sack, with could have been $3,000-$4,000 in it. And, you know, A, there was the temptation of this is a lot of money, but B, there was the fear that somebody would find out and hit you over the head with it and take it. So that was kind of a crazy, scary type thing.
What year was this?
I was 14, 15, so it was 72, 73.
So not a good time to be walking around.
No. It was pretty scary, pretty scary. You know, then you'd have at the end of the day, because I think we shut down at 6 o'clock. So at 6 o'clock, all the tickets that hadn't been turned in, you basically had to go scour the beach because some people abandoned. They basically left the chairs and umbrellas out there. They didn't get their $2 deposits back, but they just didn't want to drag them back or bother with them. They hit the subway or wherever they were going. Mm-hmm. So we would go and drag those back. But then you had people who just didn't want to leave the beach at 6 o'clock and didn't want to surrender and give up their chairs. So it got pretty contentious sometimes. You know, you had to say to somebody, you got to get up, we need the chair, we have to close. So there were lots of characters, lots and lots of characters on the beach.
So did these skills go on to serve you throughout the rest of your life?
Absolutely, unquestionably. You know, it was customer service, dealing with people. You know, at one point you were the person who would put the chairs in them, set up the chairs, and dig the umbrellas into the ground. Then when you had done that for a while, you sort of got elevated and then managed the stand and became the cashier. So you proved yourself responsible to be dealing with cash. And Bob was a Coney Island legend, Bob Myers. He was a Coney Island legend. We used to call him the King of the Beach, also the Chairman of the Boardwalk. Get it? Chairman.
Yeah,
chairman
that's really
of the
good.
Was what he was known as. But he was a legendary character. Legendary character. It's fun times. Making a dollar and a quarter, $1.40 an hour.
In the early 1990s, the Coney Island beach was severely eroded after a series of violent storms, and it needed replenishment. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers pumped 3 million cubic yards of sand from offshore, raising the beach 13 feet to the level of the boardwalk. In this 2018 oral history, Crystal Isley recalls growing up in the 1980s and 90s at Coney Island houses, where her bedroom window overlooked the beach and the sounds of the ocean lulled her to sleep at night. She recalls hanging out with a group of friends in their hidden playground under the boardwalk until access to it was filled in with sand, forever changing her world. The Army Corps created a tall sand berm that was designed to prevent storm surges from coming ashore. Access to the space below the boardwalk was blocked off forever and could no longer provide shade and privacy for beachgoers.
I grew up around 31st Street and Surf Avenue. So my window overlooked the beach and I had a great view of the beach and the water. So I woke up every morning to an amazing sunrise. And just went to sleep every night with the beach sound. And while you didn't realize it at the time, Coney Island Houses was, to me, was the greatest location to live at. I would say there was always a group of 8 of us at any given time. And we pretty much were able to go anywhere within distance of within distance of realizing that there's someone looking out for us. But the one thing that we found, like a sense of privacy, once we did figure out, hey, they're watching us from like the park or wherever it is, we found under the boardwalk, it was like a zone that you couldn't find us. It was our little hidden playground, so to say. And I would just spend time under there. In the summertime, that was the coolest place to hang out because it was literally cool. It was the shadiest place to hang out. If you're out in the summertime, at the time, you'd always see people hang up hammocks or they would just have their sheets with the radios playing and just, you could just lay out there for hours on end until the sun went down and you knew you had to go back home. And because further up, the higher up you got, at in the 30s, the beach was so much closer. The water was so much closer to the buildings than what it is now. And at that time, they used to take the sand after the flooding consistently would happen. I think it must have hit us, I would say, in my time remembering, I would say maybe three or four times, which is enough, I remember them taking sand in the middle of the night. These crews would come out and they would take sand. I don't know if it was from the middle of the ocean and fill in the gap and fill in the space between the water and the boardwalk. I remember at one point they was around West 33rd Street. There was almost a point where you could walk off of the boardwalk and take a few steps and you would almost be touching the ocean. You wouldn't find that now. That's because of all the work that they did, adding sand to the beach. But prior to adding sand to the beach, they took a lot of the sand and pushed it underneath the boardwalk. And so when that happened, it stopped a lot of access points, because there used to be a direct access point to the beach right out of my building off the 31st and Surf. And it stopped access points and people would still try to find a way, but you just couldn't. So once you closed up underneath the boardwalk, I felt like, all right, that's one part. I knew it was due to safety measures more so, and to, you know, save the rest of, in case this happened again. But it was just, it never felt the same after that, because that immediate access was gone. But I just remember once that final sand was pushed under the boardwalk, it kind of started to change. That was the beginning to me of the change. It probably also was the beginning of the time of who I was. You're going through these teenage phases and everything changes. But visually, that was just a key point to me.
Thank you for listening to Coney Island Stories, the Coney Island History Project podcast. This episode was produced by Charles Denson, Ali Lemer, and Trisha Vita. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. The oral histories were conducted by Charles Denson, Amanda Deutsch, Samira Tazari, and Trisha Vita between 2009 and 2019. You can listen to the full interviews featured in this podcast in our oral history archive at coneyislandhistory.org. If you have a question or would like to record an oral history, contact us via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or our website. Stay tuned for the next episode of Coney Island Stories.
This program is supported in part by funding from Humanities New York, provided by the CARES Act and the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, in partnership with the City Council and New York City Councilman Mark Traeger.